Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
The sounds of a Martian symphony. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We have a pretty good idea as to what Mars looks like, thanks to telescopes, satellites, and rovers on the ground. It's red, it's dusty, and it's barren. But what does it sound like? Well, microphones on the surface of Mars are capturing the sounds of the red planet. We'll hear about the tech that brings us those sounds. And one way to use Martian sounds is to make Martian music. One composer is harnessing those auditory captures from the red planet in a new symphony. The art and science of out-of-this-world sounds. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Mars Symphony is a new work by composer David Ibbett that harnesses the sounds of Mars and transforms them into musical instruments and melodies. This isn't the first cosmic work for Ibbett. He composed Black Hole Symphony, transforming the destructive waves formed by black holes into a musical piece. Ahead of its debut at the Museum of Sciences in Boston, we spoke with Ibbett about his inspiration for scientific symphonies. David, welcome to the show.
It's nice to meet you, Brendan. Thanks so much for having me.
Likewise. And this is such a unique conversation. You wrote a symphony about Mars. Tell me a bit about this project.
Well, so I direct a project called Multiverse Concert Series, and we're really focused on connecting music and science, you know, using music to celebrate science and then using science to inspire music and emotion and kind of a perspective on this moment that we're all at, this incredible technological time we're in. We've been going for 4 or 5 years now, and then sort of longer than that in my own work. And this is the second symphony. So we did and are still playing Black Hole Symphony, which is a planetarium symphony. So musicians in the planetarium created in partnership with the Museum of Science Boston.
Black Hole Symphony, that has piqued my interest. What does a black hole sound like? Because I would assume that sounds like nothing. Or chaos or destruction.
Well, so a black hole itself doesn't emit anything that we can detect. Possibly these very tiny particles, the Hawking radiation, but nothing that we can actually measure. But around the black hole itself, huge amount of emission of light, the accretion disk. That famous image of the black hole, the center of the Milky Way, is of the accretion disk, this plasma that radiates in sort of high energy waves. So I use a technique called sonification, where we take these different light sources and X-rays, radio, coming out of the different components of the black hole galaxy and make musical melodies and musical harmonies. And I do this working closely with scientists, and we ended up bringing in a big science team, all these different movements about different aspects of the black hole, because it's not just a vacuum cleaner hole in space. There's that disk that I mentioned. There are clouds of boiling gas. There's dust, which could contain planets and asteroids. There's jets of plasma that shoot out into space. And the way that we detect these things is with telescopes and also with gravitational wave detectors. And these all produce signals, which are often waves. And of course, you can listen to waves as sound. So there are a number of ways that I can turn these into music, or sometimes they already are music, and I just need to put them into a concert.
David, when you first went through that process of turning these different waves, whether they be, you know, light waves or radio waves, into sound, were you surprised at what it actually sounded like?
Well, I definitely got inspired by scientists who were doing the same thing. So that the word sonification, it sounds a bit of a mouthful, but it's just like visualization. Your typical visualization is a graph. You know, you've got a variable that's something that's going up and down over time. And if to the trained eye, a graph can look meaningful, but to somebody who's not in that field, it, can look like a squiggle. So there are already scientists who are using sonification. And the most famous one is definitely the sound of two black holes colliding from LIGO. This is a gravitational wave, and it's a historic detection. You know, it's one of Einstein's theories that, you know, almost 100 years later is shown to be correct. And just so happens that those gravitational waves are moving at a speed where our ears can pick them up if we map it directly into sound. So there's plenty of LIGO. They call it the chirp. It's a whoop. It's a very rapid glissando upwards caused by two small black holes orbiting faster and faster and then colliding. So there's already a music there. And what one of the things I did was to sort of work on that sound. The reason it's a sort of a high sound like that is they're small black holes. So larger black holes, nobody's detected a medium, like intermediate mass or supermassive black holes. Nobody, to my knowledge, I don't know, there's all sorts of research coming out, has detected larger ones merging. But they try to guess what that signal would look like, and it moves very slowly, too slow for our ears to be able to pick it up. It would be kind of infrasound. So one of the techniques I used in Black Hole Symphony was to take one of these slow waves and have it move a trombone slide up and down, so to modulate a trombone. So we have the trombone going up and down as the dance of the supermassive black holes. Taking it for research and then seeing, you know, I have a completely different skill set to the scientists. You know, I'm classically trained composer, but I have to make sure I get it right. I have to get my head around the research, and that takes a lot of time.
I had a conductor who always told me, you know, we didn't invent music, we discovered it. And it seems like this is the perfect application of that. There's music pretty much everywhere in our universe. As a composer, are the melodies there, or are you taking the sound and having to turn it into something that is appealing to our ear, or are these melodies and harmonies existing within our cosmos and you are just capturing them and giving it to an audience?
So sometimes they're just right there. I mean, not every time, but that LIGO sound I keep coming back to, you know, they really didn't have to do very much to make that audible. There's a scene in Black Hole Symphony of plasma jets flaring up and down. And that one makes a really good bass solo, electro bass, because it has... It stays around the low range, kind of oscillating up and down. And then occasionally it makes these massive leaps as a big kind of blob of plasma comes out. So there's usually a kind of music to match the data. You know, music is so diverse. So a lot of what I'm doing is I'm looking at some data and I'm thinking, you know, if we want to communicate that in a human way with the language that we all understand, I believe that's what music is. There's usually a musical way to do it. Sometimes it's more direct than others. And, you know, sometimes you just get a gift and the universe writes the music for you, which is the dream.
David, let's talk about your next piece, the Mars Symphony. And I know with Mars, we've had some people on this podcast that actually have put microphones on the surface of Mars. Is it a little bit different gathering sound from, say, the red planet as opposed to a black hole? What is going into capturing the inspiration and the sounds for this upcoming symphony?
So with Mars, we have access to actual sound recorded from the surface. And with black hole, what we're really working with is light, because light has reached us from black hole galaxies. Well, there are some recreations of sound within a galaxy, but there's, you know, we can't get really a microphone close enough to a black hole. With Mars, you know, I'm able to work with all the sound that's been released by NASA from the rovers and from the InSight lander. And some of those sounds are just so beautiful that we just wanted to put them into a concert hall. And, you know, a lot of the times when you experience these sounds, you get them in your feed, you know, you get them in Reddit or on Instagram, and you hear them out of your phone. It sounds okay. But there's a lot more going on. So putting them in a concert hall with a surround sound system, you can really feel like you're on Mars. So we begin the piece with a Martian soundscape that's recorded from Perseverance rover, largely. And then out of that, the melodies grow. So the first instrument you really hear is the flute, the winds of Mars moving into the the wind instruments. The first movement's called Mars Remembers. Well, we're learning a lot more about the history of Mars from the rovers, and it's, you know, it's written across its surface. And so we, you know, in this first movement, we imagine Mars remembering its dramatic past and all of the cataclysmic events that, you know, have turned it into a kind of an inhospitable place now. But at one point, it's likely had oceans and volcanic vents and an atmosphere and could have harbored life. And, well, we may know if it did harbor life in the next couple of missions. It's a very exciting time.
What is it like as a composer, you know, hearing what is on the surface of Mars? What was it like for the first times that you heard these things? You heard the Martian winds, and you can hear the seismic activity of the planet. What reaction did you have?
Well, I mean, my ears are kind of my primary mode, and it's just magical. It takes you there so quickly, and to hear it, to be surrounded by it, I think, is what really makes it magical. So, you know, we've been working with the Science Museum in Boston, and we're building this special concert hall for the experience, and sometimes we're in a planetarium. So just, I've spent a lot of this project surrounding myself with the winds, and we had the seismic activity, so the rumbles, and you know, some of that you can just about hear if you have a subwoofer. I mean, you play these things back, and you get nothing out of a phone. You need like a gigantic subwoofer to feel these Mars quakes. But they're one of the main sources for telling us the history of the planet, you know, what's going on in the core.
Finally, David, you know, this is, as you mentioned, this is such an immersive experience, this auditory experience. You are taking the audience to Mars. What do you hope they take away from listening to this composition of yours?
Well, I think it's really a journey through my engaging with Mars, and I'm hoping that, like me, people will gain just such an appreciation and fascination for the planet. It's not just a place that we could build a space station, maybe. It's a planet with its own fascinating history and areography, Martian geography. So a lot of the piece is spent either being immersed in modern-day Mars or going back into the history of Mars and experiencing its oceans and volcanic eruptions and asteroid impacts. The second movement of the piece is called Areography, and we are journeying around the planet across its major latitude lines. And I have a sonification where I thought, could we play Mars like a record? Could we put a stylus right down onto the surface, and then as the mountains and the craters move up and down, I could use that to drive a melody, and that would be a way for me to get to know the surface of Mars, and then perhaps it would write the melody. I had kind of a tight schedule, so I had to get Mars to write the melodies. So I ended up picking six latitude lines to do this, to drop a stylus and then have it rotate, you know, from east to west. So we have the line of Olympus Mons, the largest mountain volcano in the solar system. We've got the Hellas Planitia, this incredibly deep crater. The North and South Poles, which have got evidence of frozen water. The other Tharsis mountains, and we cross over the Valles Marineris on the way to Olympus Mons, so I got that one. Each one of these sort of trips around Mars ends up being a melody, and we appreciate them one by one. Each of them ends up with its own theme and its own musical instruments. As we cross over a major feature, we get a dip down or a zip up if it's a crater or a mountain. So I just want people to leave with a mental map of Mars and a musical map of Mars, because it's a planet that is out there, and it has this rich surface full of sights that we've never seen, but they are there, and perhaps we will get to see them and appreciate them one day with our own eyes.
Still to come, sounds from Mars came from tiny microphones on robotic explorers.
we'll learn about the tech of Out of This World mics. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. A microphone on Mars is capturing fascinating sounds of the planet. Installed on the SuperCam instrument, this tiny mic designed for hearing aids has captured Martian winds and the sounds of NASA's Ingenuity helicopter flying on the red planet. Andy Bellavita is with Knowles, the company that developed the tech. He joins us now to talk about the long legacy of microphones in space.
So tell me a bit about this microphone. It's on the SuperCam instrument, and it was developed to listen to these laser ticks, right? Tell me a bit about the microphone.
Yeah, it's interesting. The microphone has a long history, and probably I should step back a little bit and describe why the microphone was invented in the first place. Our company's founder, Hugh Knowles, when the transistor was invented, saw immediately the application to miniaturize hearing aids. In his day, if you think, for example, the early Rocky movies, Rocky had the coach, Mickey, played by Burgess Meredith, and he had that old-style hearing aid where he had a big belt unit and a wire running up to his ear. Well, with miniature transistors, you had the possibility of getting the hearing aids up on the face, but would also take high reliability and robust sub-miniature microphones and speakers, and that's what Hugh Knowles concentrated on. And so after he developed those, really those same characteristics would come to appeal to NASA when they were also required to provide communications in very miniature bases. And actually, our first application for NASA was for the Apollo missions. They needed a smaller than normal headset for the Apollo missions that would fit under the headgear and the helmet of the astronauts. But NASA needed a sub-miniature high-performance microphone element to go inside the gooseneck of that headset. And so NASA approached Knowles, and it's actually funny. There's a biography of Hugh Knowles written by a woman named Susan Goodwillie. And she told how NASA required a test to verify that the mic could survive 50 Gs. Well, Knowles actually had to build special equipment to test that low. They were normally verifying their standard hearing aid mics to 2,000 Gs. So it's a perfect fit for NASA. And thus, you know, Neil Armstrong's famous words came out of a Knowles microphone through that headset.
Why? I mean, was it just because of the size is why they went with a microphone like this using this hearing aid technology? I'm curious to know why they even approached Knowles in the first place.
Exactly that. It was the size, because Knowles was making the smallest, most high-performance microphones possible to get them in hearing aids that you could wear at your ear.
Gotcha. So how do we go from, recording Neil Armstrong's famous words from the lunar surface to hearing sounds on Mars? I mean, why was this microphone selected for the Perseverance mission?
Well, it actually started more than 20 years ago with Carl Sagan. He was one of the founders of the Planetary Society. And he campaigned with NASA to get a microphone on a Mars lander strictly so that people could hear the sounds of Mars. He actually wrote a letter to NASA in 1996 that said, and I quote him from the Planetary Society website, "Even if only a few minutes of Martian sounds are recorded from this first experiment, the public interest will be high and the opportunity for science exploration real." So that was 1996, and it actually went on the Mars Polar Lander in 1999 strictly for that purpose, but unfortunately the Polar Lander crashed. But the microphone that was designed in at that time, a very high performance, high sensitivity hearing aid microphone, designed and actually by an engineer at Knowles named Tim Wickstrom, who's still working for Knowles today and hugely excited that 20 years later, the microphone that he worked with NASA on originally is now actually on Mars and working. But they chose it because of the small size, high sensitivity, and also it was able to withstand the high radiation and the extreme temperatures on Mars. Now, it ended up, because that mission failed, it ended up being selected again for the Netlander, which that mission was canceled, and then on the Phoenix lander in 2008. But the greater system that incorporated the mic of the Phoenix lander had some problems, and so they were forced to leave it turned off the whole time. And so then we take ourselves all the way to 2021 with Perseverance, where finally it's landed on the planet and is performing well. Now, in exchange for that long wait, the microphone is actually doing science rather than just there so people could listen to the sounds of Mars. But the mic having been space qualified once was just carried over through all those missions. And so it's the same microphone that was originally specified for the Polar Lander was selected by the French agency ISAE Super Arrow, who built the SuperCam. They selected the same microphone because it was already proven.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the thought was because it's a part of this SuperCam mission and it's there for science, it might not even pick up these sounds of Mars. So, I mean, explain why hearing things on Mars is perceived as such a challenge. Sound obviously operates differently on this planet. Why is that, and what's the challenge to a microphone manufacturer like yourself?
So the main reason is because the atmosphere is very thin on Mars, and so sound won't propagate nearly as well. And actually, in the press conference that NASA and the associated agencies had when they announced the first tests of SuperCam, they explained how even two people standing 6 feet apart wouldn't be able to talk to each other because of the thin atmosphere. I mean, apart from the lack of oxygen, the fact that it's so thin that the sound doesn't propagate very well. So an extremely highly sensitive microphone was required. And it's interesting because they anticipated being able to hear the sounds of Mars, and they knew they would hear the sound of the laser. But the really amazing thing was on the fourth Ingenuity helicopter flight, they used the microphone to listen and picked up the sound of the rotor blades while it was in flight. And David Mimoun, the project leader for the microphone system at ISAE, he actually expressed surprise that the mic was able to hear the helicopter from so far away. But that's because of the extreme sensitivity of the microphone. And I have to add that this is an off-the-shelf microphone. You could take out your credit card and buy one in small quantities for about $15 this very day. Nothing special about that microphone other than the application it was originally designed for, hearing aids, also suits this application on Mars.
Yeah, it might be cheap to get the microphone, but the ride to another planet is what's going to cost you a lot, right?
Yeah, and I'm willing to go in advance to replace it if necessary.
So, I mean, so you weren't expecting it, you're hearing this sound. I mean, what is it like for you, for someone who works with this product, to be able to hear these sounds that it's picking up? I mean, we're hearing winds from Jezero Crater. We're hearing the rotor blades of the Ingenuity rover. That's got to be incredible, right?
It was amazing, really. I was tuning into all of it when they had the press conference and played the very first sounds. They did it on the first day. They hadn't even unfurled SuperCam yet, so it was still stowed away, and they turned on the mic and still were able to get the sounds of Mars. What a thrill that was.
It's an off-the-shelf product. I mean, is there anything that you're learning from this mission that you can bring back here and improve this technology for hearing health or for next-generation hearing aid microphones? I mean, is that part of the process at all?
Well, it actually was part of the process because this microphone is an older model, actually. You know, again, it had been specified as early as 2008. In hearing aid microphones have advanced considerably since then. This particular microphone actually isn't used in hearing aids anymore. So we actually have, over that intervening 20 years, been improving the design of the hearing aid microphones so that hearing impaired people can have a better quality of life and hear better under more challenging circumstances.
Mm-hmm. And tell me a little bit about, I know you said this is an older model on the SuperCam, but when you say hearing aid microphone, I'm thinking very, very small. How small is this microphone to pick up these big sounds that it's doing?
It's a few millimeters square.
So it's tiny.
It's tiny. And the newer models are even tinier still, but this one's quite small. You know, it's although it's not used in hearing aids today, there's some other really interesting applications where such a high sensitivity and robust mic are used. For example, it's used in a military gunshot detection system, which uses an array of them, and from the shockwave of a bullet passing by, that microphone array and the software that goes with it can actually detect a direction the bullet came from. So it has a good military use, and it's using a lot of research too. For example, it'll extend into high ultrasonic frequency, so it's often used for bat detection. both for scientific purposes, but also more practical ones. They're mounted on the nacelles of wind turbines, and if they detect when bats are migrating, if they're migrating through the area where the wind farm is, they'll turn off the turbines so as not to harm the bats.
It's such a fascinating, this is a hearing aid microphone that is picking up sounds on Mars, but also picking up sounds of bullets and bats. Like it's really like a really interesting use case. Andy, obviously it's on SuperCam. This hardware is for science, but we've seen just how absolutely excited people have been to hear the sounds of Mars. There have been people advocating for microphones, as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, on these Martian missions. But seeing the success of this particular microphone on Perseverance, can we see microphones on future spacecraft? I mean, is this something that you think will be added on the base model of your next rover that's going to another planet or someplace else?
Well, I don't see why not, because of the scientific contribution. Now, in that press conference, it was explained that, and this was Naomi Murdoch again, she talked about how the laser can determine the composition of a material, but there's a certain limit because, and she used the example of chalk and marble. If you do the laser spectroscopy on chalk and marble, you'll get the same sound or the same signature coming back. And yet you want to know if it's chalk versus marble. And so without the acoustic signature of the laser blast, you cannot discriminate between them. But the hardness of the material can be told by the acoustics. And so therefore the combination of the laser and the microphone can determine the material more finely than the laser alone. And so I don't know why you wouldn't do that in other space missions in which you're going to do laser spectroscopy, provided there's an atmosphere to work with.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a radio guy, you don't have to convince me on the importance of microphones. So hopefully, hopefully the scientific community sees the importance of this, and the public relations and public excitement that this microphone is bringing is just incredible. We've been speaking with Andy Bellavia. He's the director of market development for Hearing Health Tech at Knowles. Andy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Andy Bellavita is with Knowles, the company that develops space microphones. That conversation first aired June 22nd, 2021. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do so on the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? This is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Welcome, Alessandro. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.